Welcome to Media Talk. I'm Matt Wells. The new Murdoch in town. What was young James doing at the Labour Party conference? Managing a media nightmare. How the Republicans are coping with Palin.
This woman will be one 72-year-old's heartbeat away from being president of the United States. And if that doesn't scare the hell out of you, it should. I'm 65 and have been covering politics as you have for a long time. That is one of the most pathetic pieces of tape I have ever seen for someone aspiring to one of the highest offices in this country.
ITV in play, is a takeover battle looming?
This is my daughter. She's a big, brave girl and she's going to have an operation today.
Age?
Nearly six.
You're five.
And Little Britain draped in the stars and stripes. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. In the week when Britain's favourite jiggy bankers, Ant and Dec, were pictured in Afghanistan, of all places, I turn to my guests, Emily Bell and Owen Gibson, and ask them, who from the TV industry would you like to send to the front line, Emily?
Such an unfair question. Don't you know, now I'm in management, they're all my showbiz mates. None of them.
What about you, Owen? How about...
I think all of Channel 4's The Family, en masse.
No, I love The Family. Not as individuals.
I can't work out whether I like that programme or hate it. It's one of those ones where I watch through my...
I love what they've done.
I think it's a great program,
love
but
what
they,
done.
They drive me mad.
You wouldn't want them as neighbours.
Next door, no. Yeah.
Let's start with a bit of politics, shall we?
Now I would like to welcome to the stage, to address us all... my husband, the leader of the Labour Party, your Prime Minister, Gordon Brown.
I always want to vomit when I hear that. That was Sarah Brown in Manchester in a perfect moment of media management. And goodness knows, politicians need plenty of managing right now. The Guardian's US correspondent Suzanne Guldenberg has been looking at how the Republican Party has been coping with Sarah Palin. Badly, it would seem, if you've seen those Katie Couric interviews. We'll hear from Suzanne in a moment. But first, The Observer's media editor James Robinson has been on the conference circuit in Britain, and he's found that the situation in the UK is a good deal more complex. Some things never change, though, and as he writes in an article for The New Statesman this week, there's still a Murdoch at the centre of the circus.
Quite, yeah, a younger Murdoch. Yeah. Murdoch 2.0.
So he was at the Labour Party conference, and intriguing that Gordon Brown found time for him in the night before his huge speech. So does this indicate that James Murdoch has taken on the sort of mantle of his father as a kingmaker in the British media, do you think?
Well, I think it does. I think it's very telling that Gordon Brown made time for him, as you say. James Murdoch is someone that everyone's falling over themselves to meet and get to know because... as we all know, he now runs a very powerful stable of newspapers. The question is, I guess, you know, is Rupert still pulling the strings? I'd imagine the answer to that would probably be yes. But
because it's still Rupert Senior that's kind of opening the doors for Gordon Brown on the world stage, isn't it?
Well, this is, if you talk to people close to the heart of government, they insist. You might say this is crediting Murdoch with a power he doesn't possess, but that's almost irrelevant, isn't it? Because as long as they think he's a global player with access to world leaders, they'll continue to value his opinion. Mm. He will tell Kevin Rudd or even George Bush that you have to listen to Gordon Brown on the economy in particular. So as long as that's the case, he remains a hugely influential figure, as he has been for 20 years or more.
And it's interesting to see now how Gordon Brown is kind of trying to position himself, because clearly he's, as you say, trying to keep in with the Murdochs, but also he's clearly being advised. A really interesting aspect of all of this is the use of his wife, Sarah Brown, to give this more sort of compassionate image. What did you make of the use of Sarah Brown at the conference?
It seems to have been a masterstroke. It went down very well, didn't it? I think it was well received. Sarah Brown seems to have become a sort of unofficial press attaché, if you like, for her husband.
Because she's working behind the scenes as well, you think?
She is working behind the scenes, seemingly, to build, you know, relationships with the likes of Rebecca Wade and so on. And Gordon, I imagine, doesn't have time to, you know, press the flesh as much as he would like.
And he doesn't like doing it.
And he is a natural. Mm. And Sarah Brown seems to be better at it.
Now, what about David Cameron and his sort of media management situation? He's being looked after by the former News of the World editor, Andy Coulson.
Well, I think Coulson has had a big impact. He's certainly improved relations, certainly with broadcasters, actually, more than possibly with the press. I mean, he's very aware of the power of the sofa in daytime TV, GMTV. I think there's a certain reticence amongst senior Tories to submit themselves to questions from
the GMTV
sofa. Yeah. But that's certainly something that he's extremely aware of, and he's been very good at that. I mean, I think there was an assumption that because he has great contacts at News International, he would somehow persuade the Sun to back Cameron rather than Brown. I think that's far too simplistic, but certainly he's had a huge impact.
And we have seen this week that the Sun has come out very strongly in favour of Cameron after the conference speech.
Yeah, no, it has. I mean, it has. At the same time, I don't think the Sun is selling Brown either, to use a city parlance. You know, I think the Times may be selling Brown, but it's all to play for, you know. Right. And with these titles, with their immense power and market-leading positions, you know, they're the titles that really are undecided. Mm. You know,
and it's interesting. I watched that Panorama with David Cameron, where Nick Robinson really had kind of unfettered access to David Cameron. And do you detect the hand of Andy Coulson in that?
Yeah, no, that is Coulson. I mean, there was rumours going around that Coulson had been quite heavy-handed in the making of that programme. If you speak to Nick Robinson, he'll say that isn't the case. He certainly gets it. You know, he understands it. It's a bit like Campbell in the sense that he understands the camera angles that need to be used, the questions that need to be asked. But he's certainly he's a key member of the Cameron team. And I think if Cameron does get the media on side, he'll be a key reason for that.
Not everyone's got nice things to say about Damien McBride, who's Brown's PR man.
That's true. I mean, Damien McNasty, some call him, don't they? I think that's a function of dealing with journalists on the incredibly voracious and hostile and aggressive British media on a day-to-day basis. I mean, my personal view is that McBride has been extremely good for Brown, actually, because if you think that the last 12 months have been an atrocious year for Gordon, I think McBride has played a very big part in keeping even the most hostile Tory press, if not on side, then less hostile than they otherwise might have been. He plays the game. He knows when a paper needs a story, when a journalist is struggling for a scoop, and he will help when necessary. And he's actually remarkably popular in the lobby, or certainly the political journalists I know rate him very highly.
James Robinson there with a picture of the politico-media landscape in Britain. Now, over in the US, much of the media focus has been on Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin. With her, the media complaint is that party bosses are keeping her in a box.
Frankly, I have had it, and I know a lot of other women out there are with me on this. I have had enough of the sexist treatment of Sarah Palin. It has to end. She was here in New York City today meeting with world leaders at the UN. And what did the McCain campaign do? They tried to ban reporters from covering those meetings. And they did ban reporters from asking Governor Palin any questions. Tonight, I call on the McCain campaign to stop treating Sarah Palin like she is a delicate flower that will wilt at any moment.
That's CNN's Campbell Brown. Well, the Republicans did let her out in a series of interviews with CBS anchor Katie Couric. And my, was that a bad idea?
And when it comes to establishing your worldview, I was curious, what newspapers and magazines did you regularly read?
I've read most of them, again, with a great appreciation for the press, for the media.
But like, what ones specifically? I'm curious that you...
All of them, any of them that have been in front of me over all these years. I have a vast variety of sources where we get our news.
Well, she obviously reads The Guardian, clearly. by now, you will have seen how she got on in the vice presidential debate. But before that started, I talked to The Guardian's US correspondent, Suzanne Guldenberg, and I asked her first if Palin was the media liability that she's made out to be.
Well, going into the debate, certainly it seemed as if Sarah Palin was a walking disaster. I mean, opinion polls were showing that up about a third of voters gave Sarah Palin as a reason not to vote for John McCain. And a lot of that has to do with her disastrous performance in a number of interviews.
What is the Republican Party manager's strategy confronted by this evidence? How are they managing her media appearances?
Well, I think the management of Sarah Palin's media appearances is part of the problem. If you remember, she sort of burst onto the political scene about 5 weeks ago, and nobody knew who she was, and the Republican impulse at the very beginning was to control her, to really clamp down. So, in fact, there were suggestions she might not give any interviews at all. They kept everything very close and very scripted. Indeed, she's been advised and controlled by members of the George Bush White House. So you saw that sort of strain of total media control coming through. And I think what that did was to make the two full-length interviews, television interviews to ABC and CBS that Sarah Palin has done so far, it gave them huge importance. And when she appeared to be scripted and when she frankly didn't know what she was talking about, it made it look all the more worse, all the worse.
Is that a situation, do you think, Suzanne, that can continue for the rest of the campaign? Or would Sarah Palin's media advisors just be better to let her be herself, I guess?
Well, it got to the point where you had television anchors sort of only half jokingly launching a campaign called, you know, Free Sarah Palin, let her get out from her media controllers, let her talk to the people, let Sarah be Sarah. I think we are seeing the beginnings of that. On the heels of the sort of disastrous interview with Katie Couric, you saw Palin giving a number of interviews to very friendly, very sympathetic right-wing anchors and radio commentators. So you saw the Republicans making her more available, but still very cautious, only to, you know, sympathetic hosts.
And more broadly, how has the economic situation, how has that that presumably has kind of overshadowed any kind of media strategy that the both campaigns might have, and how have they been responding to that?
Well, absolutely. The economy has now become the issue of this campaign, and I think it really has affected the way the voters see Palin in particular. At the beginning, when she was first named as John McCain's running mate, Palin's inexperience, if you like, her freshness, her novelty, seemed like an asset, like a breath of fresh air. Well, you know, if you move forward 2 weeks and you have, you know, the Wall Street meltdown and Congress unable to come to a deal, those qualities, which once seemed so appealing, in fact seem rather scary. And I think that's played into things very heavily and sort of really eroded John McCain's standing in the polls.
Suzanne Goldenberg there. Before we talk about Sarah Palin, Emily Bell, let's go back to the UK situation and what James Robinson was saying. Has James Murdoch, another James, has he sort of become secretly replaced his father as the most influential media mogul in Britain then? When did that happen?
I think you'll find we've been saying this for some
have
time.
Not secret.
I think this happened probably conclusively when he took over effectively from Les Hinton, but retained his footing at Sky.
So this is taking over the papers as well as the...
Exactly, and moving everybody into his Wapping campus, Wapping in both senses. He's very smart, he's 35, he understands digital media, he is the man most likely to succeed his father. Inevitably, whilst news has the scale of investment it has in the UK, James Murdoch is going to be the man.
It's interesting, Owen, that he was the one person who Gordon Brown was able to make time for in the hours before his speech at the party conference in Birmingham. Instead of putting the final touches to his speech, he was
absolutely
meeting
and probably no great surprise. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that you know, kind of every 2 or 3 years we try and kind of say, oh, newspapers aren't as important as they used to be, and you know, politicians won't need to court them. And yet here we are with a new generation of kingmakers and a new generation of kind of politicians courting them, if you like. It's quite interesting how closely Murdoch Jr.'s politics are aligned with the new Conservatives, actually.
I think that's absolutely right. But it's also interesting that, of course, because James Murdoch was at Sky, and if you think about, you know, Tim Allen was certainly sort of corporate affairs advisor to them both kind of internally and then at Portland, there's a very, very strong Blair connection. And I think that Blair is more closely aligned probably to Cameron than to Brown in some of that sort of mapping. And you can imagine that Brown probably feels quite anxious about that, because we all know probably the schisms within Downing Street are much greater than some of the schisms between the centre-left and the centre-right.
Meanwhile, you've got this sort of Rupert Elder Dacre Brown axis that's also kind of interesting and shifting and is happening kind of
it's all quite complex, isn't it? Because Murdoch has both Murdochs have tentacles in all sorts of places. You know, his Murdoch Senior's best economic buddy, Erwin Stelzer, is a big friend of Brown and is opening doors for Brown around the world. And if Erwin Stelzer was suddenly to say it's all over for Brown, then it would be.
The Murdoch camp has always just been supremely pragmatic and very, very good at interpreting poll data. You know, he's not an idealist, and he has an ideology which sort of roughly aligns sort of around the anti-regulation free market, and James Murdoch is no different from his father in that respect. But they will be closest to whoever is going to form the next government.
And you can see that in the US and you can see it over here.
You can see it over here. And I think that the chances of Brown forming the next government are decreasingly likely, though we don't know because the financial meltdown is going to sort of throw up all sorts of kind of interesting things in terms of, you know, whether or not Cameron looks like enough of a statesman. So they're just playing the percentages. It's like I saw Murdoch in New York doing an interview.
James or Murdoch
Senior?
Sorry,
Murdoch Senior. Yeah. And this was the one where he said, oh, well, we had a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton. And he was the guy who was interviewing him and said, really? You know, are you a supporter of her? Oh, God, no, I think it should be terrible. He said, well, why did you have a fundraiser? He said, well, because people in the office said it would be a good idea if we did. That's it. Those are the politics of. He doesn't have to court. Rupert Murdoch doesn't have to court anybody. James Murdoch doesn't. They're all courting him. Yeah. Doesn't care.
It's interesting, isn't it? You know, kind of that point has been made by a couple of sort of newspaper columnists that Cameron has effectively kind of risen to this sort of 20-point poll lead without actually having the conspicuous support of many areas of Fleet Street. Actually, bizarrely, but now is the time where you feel he actually really needs it, you know, and it's interesting to see the Sun come out cautiously for Cameron today. But you know, it's obviously his focus now, I think, and
what about
his focus.
You mentioned the US. Let's have a quick word on Sarah Palin, Emily. It's very easy to make jokes about the interviews that she gives to the media and her attitude to the media. Would you like to make some?
I just can't get past Sarah Fay. Tina Fay. Tina Fay for president, who is actually better Sarah Palin than Sarah Palin. And I just think you have to say, look at John McCain. He's 72. He's got cancer. She might be president. And then the folksy homesy, I can see Russia from my house stuff, you know, is just makes you feel absolutely kind of terrified.
But it does make you massively jealous, doesn't it? Looking across the Atlantic and looking at the fact they've got so much to talk about, if you like, compared to over here where everything is so grey and so.
We've got story envy. Look at them. Totally. They've got Obama, they've got Palin, they've got a massive financial crisis. What have we got? We've got Gordon Brown and the man who did the PR for Carlton Telly.
All right, okay, listen. You can follow the rest of the US campaign, US presidential campaign, with our fantastic coverage at guardian.co.uk/US elections. Now, no sooner had Ed Richards and Ofcom allowed ITV to take an axe to its regional news services, the broadcaster announced 1,000 job losses. Unseemly haste, the very thought. And in other ITV news this week, the Competition Commission ruled that Sky had to reduce its stake in the broadcaster to less than 7.5%, which, interestingly, raises the intriguing prospect of a takeover battle. But will anyone be interested in ITV, Owen, given that it's, you know, reduced to a shadow of its former great self, making all these job losses? Who's going to want IT?
Michael Grade would have us believe it. It's been reduced to shadow of his former self because, you know, it kind of suits him at the moment to give that impression. But obviously there are companies out there that would like Britain's leading commercial broadcaster still.
Richard Branson.
but there's many, many more rounds in this very, very long story to go yet, I think. And, you know, kind of even the side issue of this of Sky's stake, which is the thing that's going to sort of kick off this process, basically. Everyone's waiting to see what happens to that before any takeover process can start. That's going to drag on for months and months because there'll be appeal. There could be another appeal. And then there's sort of further questions over this plurality test, what exactly it means. We're going to be debating this for some time to come.
It's quite a write down on Sky's investment, isn't it, Emily? Does this call into question James Murdoch's judgment?
No, I think he did exactly the right thing. Sky can afford to lose the money. It kept Virgin out of the market and it made ITV, you know, incredibly weak. So if you're sitting in Sky camp, you can say, well, you know, the net return on investment was not very, very impressive, but actually the strategic return on investment has been considerable. And you have to say, with ad revenues being down, whatever they are at the moment, probably about 20% year on year, that things are not looking great and the price will probably fall a bit further.
Meanwhile, Mark Thompson over at the BBC, the Director General, has been sort of trying to position himself as the knight in white armour, hasn't he?
the white knight, or maybe the knight in shining armour.
When he originally came up with these very hastily cobbled together ideas that might help Channel 4 and other public service broadcasters 2 or 3 months ago, it was clearly an attempt to kind of, you know, throw up some dust and sort of say, here's some things you could do instead, and don't worry about top slicing us because we can be the answer here. From what I see, the proposals haven't moved on that much in the 2 to 3 months in between, and if you listen to the BBC's rivals, they think this is a stalling tactic. They think the BBC doesn't mean it, they don't think they can trust it to follow through on these things, and that they won't be meaningful enough to deliver real, you know, benefits. So I think the jury is still very much out, and it's up to Thompson and the BBC to prove that these things can deliver the sort of £230 million a year of benefit that will be required to prop up the other broadcasters.
At the risk of sounding like a pompous old bag, which I never do, this is what I was saying several months ago with the BBC, that they have to broker a new deal with the whole of the rest of the British media, because otherwise we're all going to be crushed under their wheels.
Well, Mark Thompson, in an article for The Guardian on Saturday, said that he would do it and it would be a significant move that he would make. But then Philip Graff, the deputy chairman of Ofcom, writing this week, said that he wasn't very impressed by what Thompson had to say.
No, well, I think it's just maybe too little and a bit too late. And actually, it has to be a systemic reworking of what exactly are the BBC's obligations. I think that's the key thing. You can't really just do it by saying, and we'll sell all of Channel 4's programmes, brackets. Channel 4 don't really have any programmes. They mostly belong to independent producers. Yeah. You know, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. It's actually, that's a kind of a goodwill gesture, if you like. It's a bit of an olive branch, but you really need to kind of have the roots of the tree doctored for this to make any real difference.
Well, let's leave that one there and just have a quick word on another Ofcom ruling. It's very exciting this week. Lots of rulings from Ofcom.
I can hardly wait.
Well,
to nip out to the loo. It's so exciting.
This is the one about Sky being made to make its channels available to competitors at a fair price. A significant ruling. Owen, you know all about this.
Well, again, this is sort of part 324 in a very, very long-running saga that's been going basically as long as Sky has been broadcasting. And it's basically Sky's rivals are complaining that Sky has all the significant content, the football, the films, the other major sport, and it doesn't sell to them at a fair enough price. They complained to Ofcom, Virgin, Santa, Top Up, and said, basically, you know, we think this is a fundamental, you know, market distortion. Split up Sky, you know, make these major moves. And actually, Ofcom have come back and gone, oh no, we're not going to split up Sky. A, because, you know, can you imagine Ofcom making such a move right now with everything else it's got on its plate? But B, you know, they've all coalesced back on this rather smaller issue of whether Sky charges a fair price for Sky Sports and for Sky Movies, basically. So what will happen under this new system is there'll be a transparent formula by which if you're BT or Virgin, you'll be able to tell 3 or 4 years out exactly how much you'll be paying for Sky Sports or Sky Movies and buy it at a certain price.
I'm glad we have you with us, Owen. if you can't wait to read more about those stories, they're all on Media Guardian.
They're all on somebody else's website, I hope. Yes.
No, they're all on our website, mediaguardian.co.uk/boring. Now, before...
It's quite good, actually. I like that. I think we should have a /boring.
We should have good. No, a very most popular part of the website as well.
just
before Emily and Owen leave us, I just want to replay this part of last week's programme where Janine Gibson was talking about Jane Tranter's departure from the BBC.
If you're in the middle of accepting a new job and somebody's approached you about it and you're in the middle of a negotiation, it's commercially sensitive, then perhaps you might not want to talk about it on air. For example, we could turn around to any member of the group in this room and say, yeah, have you got a new job? And they might say, no. So yes, you can, on a human level, we must, you know, we must show understanding.
So we could turn around...
Owen, have you got a new job?
Yes.
There we go.
Transparency.
Yes, see, transparency. Owen Gibson, I should say, leaving the media beat. What will we do? We won't have him on to be able to explain the intricacies of Ofcom rulings.
I know.
To take over as sports news correspondent.
Can you imagine?
Given the previous conversation, you don't have to ask why I'm moving on to be sports news.
Yes,
I'll now be you know sort
hooligans.
Of pouring through the arcane footnotes of Locog documents rather than Ofcom ones. I think.
You'll still have to go to Culture, Media, and Sports Select Committee.
Exactly, John Whittingdale will still be there, don't worry.
Yeah, absolutely. But we should call for Owen Gibson's resignation for failing to be open and transparent last week.
I think we should actually. Yeah. I think he lied to the country and he lied to the pod and he should be banished to sport.
Well, and there he is. Well, congratulations to Owen, and thanks also to you, Emily, for joining us this week.
Will you please give a very warm Fat Fighters welcome to Rosie O'Donnell? Lovely, so Rosie O'Donnell.
Yes.
I've been reading all about you in the Fat Fighters newsletter. Mm. I know you had your own talk show.
Yes.
Until Ellen DeGeneres filled your slot. And then it says here that you are a lesbian. Did you find it hard to get a man because of the weight and then think maybe I'll go lesbian?
That's I quite like that, actually. That's Marjorie Dawes. And
actually, that was one of the best. Sorry, go ahead.
that is not Marjorie Dawes. That's Anna Picard, who's in San Francisco for us and interrupting me. I was just going to explain to the listeners, Anna, that was, of course, the US version of Little Britain, Little Britain USA, which launched Matt Lucas and David Williams into the States last week. And Anna, were you about to say that was pretty much the only funny thing in it?
It pretty much was. I don't know what laugh track you've got, but it sounds a lot more hilarious than the one that was on the show here, but where it was slightly more muted, as was the reaction, I have to say. It was quite a good sketch and possibly the only good one in it.
So how have the critics taken to it?
Well, a lot of them seem to be of the opinion that it was quite crude and or puerile, and I think it was Variety said its wit seldom reaches above what's scrawled on the school bathroom wall. And I think most people who've seen it before, most British people would say, yes, it's Little Britain, and that's what it does, and that's the joy of it. But I think some critics found it difficult to find that joy.
How did the mixture of American and US culture go down?
It was interesting. I mean, I find it really difficult because, of course, I can only see it from a point of view of someone who's seen, you know, several series and got quite bored of it. And so for me, it was, you know, lots of cutting and pasting of familiar characters into American situations with hilarious consequences, but some of them worked better than others. The Marjorie Dawes that you just heard, that was a pretty good one. The Lou and Andy, I'm not quite sure. I think that was one for people who were familiar with the characters who had seen it already, kind of. But as a newcomer to it, I'm not quite sure it worked. It was the very first sketch in the show, and I'm not quite sure it worked. But yeah, there's a mixed reaction. I think it might be too lowbrow for an American audience, and I know some people might find that a bit of a strange sentence, but I think it might be true.
Okay. Well, this week, interestingly, we're moving into the start of the big autumn season, of course, over there, and all the networks launching their big programmes, big fanfares. How has the season started?
It's one of those not quite such with a bang as a whimper. I mean, because I think it was Fox came in a couple of weeks ago with their big ones, so House and stuff actually started a couple of weeks ago. And then the main proper beginning of the season was just this last week, and there just hasn't been one single show that everyone's talking about. No one's saying, oh, you have to watch this, or you have to, you know, you have to catch up with this and make sure you're in for it next week or whatever. And part of that is to do with the elections, and, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. And while the elections are producing a lot of good content for The Daily Show and The Colbert Report and all that kind of stuff, it's kind of distracting a bit from the drama series. Having said that, there are some really good series that are making a return and seem stronger on their return. Like, I know everyone hates it, but Pushing Daisies I love, and I'm not ashamed.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that. But it does well over there, doesn't it?
It does really well. It's very popular, and it's very, as is Chuck. And they're two that people weren't quite sure were going to work last year because they had, you know, these slightly curtailed series because of the writer's strike. So they didn't quite have the room to fill themselves out. And so people weren't quite sure whether they were going to get, you know, return or whatever, and they have returned, and they seem even stronger and more assured, I think, because of the Emmy win is particularly for Pushing Daisies, you know, a big thing. But there's no huge, oh, you've got to watch this moment, I think.
Mm. What about this this new show, The Mentalist? Now, that you talked about politically incorrect. That sounds very politically incorrect from a UK perspective. What's that about?
It isn't. It's I just like the name, but it's it's really a mentalist in terms of Darren Brown. You know, so someone who kind of reads body language and can manipulate people and you know hypnotize people. That kind of mentalist. And it's another one of these really kooky cop shows that they really love over here a lot, and when we do get them over in Britain, we kind of just stuff them away somewhere, like Monk, for example, which is again a huge series over here. It's a detective with OCD, and when I've seen it in the UK, it's been because they've run out of Murder, She Wrote to stick on. And
I think it's Murders, She Wrote, actually, technically.
Is it?
Yeah, well, yeah, because the noun is murder. And so it's Murders, She Wrote, not Murder, She Wrote. On Media Talk, we take pride in our grammar.
I'm going to go and look that up immediately and prove you wrong. However, but yeah, it's one of those, another one of these kooky detective shows. And I don't know whether it's going to travel over to Britain. And if it does, I don't know how well it will do, or whether they'll just, you know, put it on when they've run out of Diagnosis Murder, which is... Diagnosis Murder, or is it Diagnoses Murder? I'm not sure, Matt.
It's definitely Diagnoses Murder. This could get really silly, couldn't it? I think we better draw a line now. It's not draws a line. We're definitely just drawing one line at this point. Thank you very much to Anna Pickard, our correspondent in San Francisco. And in fact, that is it for Media Talk for this week. If you'd like to comment on any part of the podcast, do so on our new pages at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. The programme was produced by Scott Cawley. I'm Matt Wells, and there'll be more, if you're lucky, next week.